Hello, and welcome back to Off the Deaton Path. My name is Stan Deaton with the Georgia Historical Society, and we welcome you to our podcast for the week of February 3rd, 2020. We are broadcasting this week from the H.L. Mencken Division here at the Georgia Historical Society. This week's guest on the podcast is Jim Galloway, the longtime political columnist for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution. But before we get to Jim's interview, let's begin with a quick look at the ever-popular This Week in History. On February 3rd, 1959, 61 years ago, Buddy Holly was killed in an airplane crash along with Ritchie Valens and J.P. Richardson, the Big Bopper. This event was, of course, the subject of Don McLean's legendary 1971 song, American Pie, which immortalized February 3rd as the day the music died. On February 4th, 1913, 107 years ago, civil rights activist Rosa Parks was born in Tuskegee, Alabama. The woman known as the mother of the civil rights movement died in 2005 at the age of 92 and is buried in Woodlawn Cemetery in Detroit, Michigan. On February 5th, 1934, 86 years ago, Baseball Hall of Famer, longtime home run king, and legendary Atlanta Brave number 44, Hank Aaron, was born in Mobile, Alabama. Happy 86th birthday to the Hammer. On February 6, 1945, 75 years ago, one of the great pioneers of reggae music, Bob Marley, was born in Nine Miles, St. Anne, Jamaica. He died of malignant melanoma in Miami on May 11, 1981, at the young age of 36, and was buried close to where he was born with his favorite guitar in Jamaica. On February 7, 1964, keeping in musical history, 56 years ago, the Beatles arrived in New York City, and 2 days later appeared for the first time on The Ed Sullivan Show. The rest, as they say, is history. On February 8th, 1820, 200 years ago, United States General William Tecumseh Sherman was born in Lancaster, Ohio. He graduated from West Point in 1840 and eventually went on to one of the most distinguished, if controversial, military careers in history, which of course included the capture of Atlanta and the March to the Sea in 1864 during the American Civil War. He died at age 71 on Valentine's Day, 1891, in New York City, and is buried in Calvary Cemetery in St. Louis. And finally, on February 9, 1944, 76 years ago, writer Alice Walker was born in Eatonton, Georgia. She won the Pulitzer Prize for Fiction in 1983 for her novel, The Color Purple, and she remains one of the great writers in the African-American literary renaissance. And that's This Week in History. Finally, as many of you who are long-suffering listeners of this podcast know, in the first season of Off the Deaton Path, I would often draw your attention to an obituary that you might have missed in your news feed or in the busyness of your ordinary day. I want to do that here again today. This is a professional loss for history and a personal one for me. William McFeely, an outstanding teacher and a Pulitzer Prize-winning historian and writer and the director of my master's thesis at the University of Georgia, died on December 11, 2019, in Sleepy Hollow, New York. He died of idiopathic pulmonary fibrosis and was 89 years old. William Shield McFeely was born September 25, 1930, in New York City, and he grew up in New Jersey. His father was a grocery chain executive, his mother a homemaker and volunteer. Bill said his interest in race relations was spurred by a childhood incident in which a school picnic was almost canceled because one of his classmates was black. The picnic ended up being held at Bill's childhood home. After graduating in 1952 from Amherst College in Massachusetts, Bill worked in New York for a forerunner of the Citigroup Bank. He often traveled to country banks in West Virginia and Pennsylvania, and as he told the Boston Globe in 1999, quote, "I'd find myself walking the streets of the town and getting a sense of it. I have got, I think, the kind of curiosity that makes me able to connect the formal historical past with how people relate to it in the present," unquote. And I can tell you, it was that feel for the intensely human side of history and its connection to the present that most resonated with me as one of his students at the University of Georgia and that continues to inform everything I do as a public historian here at GHS. As the civil rights movement gained momentum, he left banking after 9 years to enter graduate school at Yale University, where he received a master's degree in 1962 and a doctorate in American studies in 1966, studying under the legendary C. Van Woodward, who was considered and is still considered the dean of historians of the American South. Dr. McFeely began a scholarly career that took him from Yale to Mount Holyoke College and finally to the University of Georgia in 1986. At Yale, he helped found one of the country's first African-American studies programs and was considered a leading authority on the Civil War and Reconstruction. His 1981 biography of Ulysses S. Grant, simply entitled Grant, A Biography, published by W.W. Norton, won the 1982 Pulitzer Prize for Biography. Dr. McFeely's next major work was a 1991 biography of Frederick Douglass, published again by W.W. Norton, and it was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize in Biography in 1992. It stood for a quarter of a century as the definitive life of Douglass until the publication of David Blight's landmark biography in 2018. In addition to being a finalist for the Pulitzer, Bill's biography of Douglass won the prestigious Lincoln Prize from the Gilder Lehrman Institute for the best nonfiction historical work on the Civil War era. As I mentioned, at Yale in the late 60s, Bill helped launch an African-American studies program, and in 1970, he moved from Yale to Mount Holyoke College in Massachusetts, where he taught for 16 years. He was at the University of Georgia, where he served as Abraham Baldwin Professor of the Humanities from 1986 until his retirement in 1997. Dr. McFeely also wrote the 1994 book, Sapelo's People, A Long Walk into Freedom, about the modern-day descendants of slaves living on that Georgia barrier island. His wife, author and librarian Mary Drake McFeely, died in 2018. They were married for 66 years. Bill had three children, seven grandchildren, one great-grandson, and a legion of students who remember his penetrating questions, his graceful scholarship, his unfailing encouragement and support, his warm humanity and friendship, and always his smile. He was one of the understated but towering historians of the second half of the 20th century, and he will be missed. William McFeely, dead at 89. A good life, well lived. Rest in peace, Bill. And now to our interview. With the Georgia General Assembly now in full swing at the Georgia State Capitol in Atlanta, I thought it would be a good time to have Jim Galloway on the podcast. Jim is the lead writer and founder of the Atlanta Journal-Constitution's Political Insider blog, the best-read and most influential political blog in the state. Jim talked with me about his work at the AJC that spanned 40 years, the future of newspapers, Donald Trump in the context of history, Georgia's changing demographics and how that will affect Georgia politics, and the future of nothing less than the American Republic. Here's Jim Galloway. Jim Galloway, welcome to the podcast.
Thank you. It's great to be here in Savannah.
Welcome to Savannah. Do you get down here very often?
Not as often as I need to. No. Maybe once a year. It's a good long drive. I had a daughter over at Georgia Southern, and we used to come a little bit more often then.
Mm-hmm. Well, let me tell our listeners that Jim Galloway is my guest today. Jim is the current political columnist for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, and correct me if anything I say is wrong. You have been an editor and writer for the AJC for 40 years, since 1979.
Right.
You are the lead writer and founder of AJC's Political Insider blog, and you are a daily guest, or you said twice a week guest, on Bill Nigut's GPB show, Political Rewind.
Correct. Mondays and Fridays.
Did I forget anything that you do?
No. That's pretty much it.
So your gig with the AJC now is exclusively on politics.
Exclusively, and it's been that way since about 2001.
Wow. 18 years. Yeah. So is that your dream job? I mean, is that your
it's kind of a third fallback.
Really?
Believe it or not. Yeah. I mean, I started at the paper. I grew up in Atlanta. Wasn't born there, but I grew up in Atlanta. Mm-hmm. And interned at the paper in 76. Then and graduated from Georgia in 77, University of Georgia. At that point, they sent you out to the hinterlands to make your mistakes, and then they brought me back in 79. The AJC at that point, it was owned by Cox Enterprises, privately held, and they were one of the smaller newspaper groups with foreign bureaus. They had one in Moscow, they had one in Jerusalem, London, then they wanted one in Tokyo. I made a bid for that. It's one of those things where if you stay in a newspaper, it rewards seniority and kind of continuity. So I missed out on the Tokyo. The Beijing office opened. I took a year off to study for that. We got there, and then the newspaper recession hit in 89, along with Tiananmen Square.
Mm-hmm.
So that kind of ended the foreign career for me. I tried to go into management. I wasn't cut out really for management. And so eventually I wandered, I got back over to the state capitol. I'd been in and out of there 3 or 4 times, and it's worked out.
Is that what you would prefer to do?
Well, at this point, you know, just given the shrinking footprint that a newspaper has, mm-hmm. yeah, that's probably the most important job I could conceive of having at mm-hmm. this point. You know, if you think about it, I mean, yeah, a foreign bureau was a little, it was the icing on a cake. Politics is the cake.
Mm-hmm. Did you know, while you were at the university and working for the paper, did you know Steve Oney?
I did not. I take that back. I did, and he was a year ahead of me, and mm-hmm. he was kind of at, you know, 2 or 3 levels in writing ahead of me, because he was a magazine guy.
Right.
He was not a newspaper guy.
Right.
But I did run into him because right out of college, he signed on with the Anderson Independent.
Right.
And he went to work in the Toccoa Bureau, which with Mitchell Shields, I believe. That was and he was notorious when it came to not meeting deadlines. He hated deadlines, and he eventually, I think they parted on pretty bad terms. And so
Steve will be listening to this.
Yeah. Well, he knows. I think he knows this, but
he'll admit to all of this, right?
Yeah. Okay. Well, given that wonderful book that he did, it took forever to get out because he was so meticulous.
Right. Leo Frank.
On Leo Frank, yep. Right? But I almost didn't get hired in Anderson because they were so suspicious of University of Georgia grads.
Because of Steve. So he almost stunted your career before it got started.
Yeah. He has seen the light since then.
Okay. So your political insider blog is tremendously influential in terms of its readership and in terms of, I know also that people in the Capitol take it very seriously. How did you build the confidence with contacts? I know this speaks to this is a very simple and somewhat stupid question to ask because it's built based upon a lifetime of being a journalist, but how do you build the kind of contacts that it takes to write a political insider blog?
Number one,
it has credibility.
Yes. You know, number one, you keep your confidences. You know, people tell you things they point you to things that are going to happen, and you respect those confidences. You don't hurt the people who help you. In most cases, in some cases, you do have to. I mean, just, you know, the truth requires that. I try to write from a perspective. I've always thought of the blog as a venue where a Democrat could go to find out what Republicans were doing and thinking, and someplace where Republicans could go to find out what Democrats were doing and thinking. That it was kind of I had no interest in being one side and not the other. It got a little hard to do when Democrats were so down on their luck, you know, after 2002, 2004, 2008, you know, because they weren't doing all that much. It's gotten a little bit trickier right now, you know, because you've got parity. But the one thing that I've done that I think has probably given me a bit of success is that I shoot for empathy. I'm trying to help the person I'm writing about in many cases make their case. You know, let them make their best case. You know, you can put some contrariness here and there, but if a man or a woman in politics is making a play, let them make the play. Let's see how it works out.
Do you find that most you said you wanted to be a place where people can go and find out what the other side is thinking? Have they told you that you succeed in that? Do you find that most Republicans and most Democrats find you an honest broker in that way?
I think they do. They don't come up to me and say, you know, but they call me if they've got something. They make sure that we know. I should write. I mean, the blog at this point, I've had many partners. The blog I started, my partnership was with Tom Baxter, who was the original columnist. I did most of the work on the blog, but he did columns, and we put his columns in there. He took a buyout, I think, in 2007. And I had matched myself generally with our Washington correspondent for several years. Then I handled it all on my own, and now we've got a kind of a trio. Greg Bluestein, who is in Atlanta, and kind of our lead guy on foot when it comes to politics, and then Tamar Hollerman, who's our Washington correspondent. You kind of have to, you know, I'm in my 40th year, as you mentioned. I'm not going to be around forever, and so you want people ready and willing to pick up when you leave when you leave off.
I know that you. You're striving, obviously, to be an honest broker in between these two, and yet I know that some people don't believe that you are. Very recently, I saw on one website your picture was with a lot of other, I think, AJC reporters, and you were all described as agenda-driven political enemies.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's part of the climate that we're in right now. I mean, we're in the Donald Trump years, and
well, do you plead guilty to that at all? I mean, do you occasionally write snarky language in there as your?
I will write sharp language. But I will. It is not written from a red point of view or a blue point of view. I will admit to being very hard on Michael Williams, who is a 2018 Republican candidate for governor, who got up in front of a GOP convention and said he had all this sort of dirt on the Republican leadership. And, you know, I walked up to him and said, okay, what's the dirt? And he says, I'll tell you later. You know, well, a year passes. He's at the state capitol, and he has a press conference, and he says, I'm going to promise you some dirt. And he walks away, and there's no dirt. And so, yeah, I came down on him pretty hard. But it wasn't because he was Republican. It wasn't because he was Democrat. It was because he was yanking our chain. And he was trying to kind of be a kind of a Donald Trump, where you have this TV reality show going on your campaign, and you're just trying to build interest, and that wasn't playing with us. It wasn't playing with me. So yeah, I can. That's probably the roughest I've been on a politician in the last 10 years or so.
Do you have personal relationships with any of the people that you cover, or do you refrain from doing that?
I'm pretty. I am number one. I'm not a joiner. I'm not a big socializer. The only friendship I will confess to is one with Max Cleland, who is long retired out of federal government. You know, I'll stop by and see him every Friday after the radio show.
So if somebody, and maybe they do, I mean, if a sitting state representative or the governor calls you and wants to have lunch with you and just talk to you. Do you ever do things like that?
I will tell you what, this governor doesn't talk to me that much. The last governor didn't talk to me that much. You know, possibly that's a reaction to what I write and what I cover. I think it has more to do with the fact that we've got a campaign and operational system where messaging has gotten so tightly controlled that the face-to-face conversations don't happen. There's also, you know, I'm at a point in my career where I'm not interested in transactional journalism. I'm not interested in saying, okay, if you tell me this first, you know, I will kind of treat you kindly. It just doesn't, you know, it it limits it, at this point, I find that too restricting.
I was going to ask you if you ever float trial balloons.
Oh, all the time, especially if they're interesting ones. Mm-hmm. And you see it happen all the time. I mean, this example that I just talked to you about Brandon Beach, you know, he was floating a reaction. He was floating an approach to the Republican version of gun safety and anti-gun violence. You know, I wanted him to float that. I wanted to be out there helping him put that idea out there just to see what would happen.
And do you consider your primary audience to be the other people in the Capitol or the readers out there, the general readers who are just trying to understand what's happening?
Well, I think the general readers. The general readers. I mean, it's interesting. We go through all these iterations of changing of platforms. You know, you're on WordPress one day, you're on something else the next day. And I used to keep very, very close eyes on page views, you know. And I think, we were up to maybe 14, 15 million a year. We were doing pretty good. So that tells me, number one, we go beyond the Capitol. But if you look at I've got a pretty good Twitter following right now. I think I'm north of 20,000. That's been a slowly building number over 10 years. So it's not the audience. The audience is growing, but it's not a parochial audience, kind of restricted to the Capitol. Mm-hmm. It actually, you know, it's in a way, it's kind of for time, you know, before the internet came along and readership was down and the recession was on us. You know, we would reduce the physical footprint of the newspaper. We would restrict where it was delivered.
Mm-hmm.
Mm-hmm. And what I've been shooting for is kind of to replace that. It is to become a statewide voice for politics, and I think in some measure we've gotten there. We've done that.
And you really have to have a balance between obviously telling your readers what's going on in Georgia politics, but also as you say, striving not to be partisan, striving to maintain good relationships with sources.
Right, right.
It's a delicate balance, I would imagine, at times.
It is.
Giving up too much and holding things back.
And, you know, and sometimes, you know, you have to write things that you know will cost you. You know, this friendship or this relationship with a source, or, you know, for 5 years or for 10 years, you know.
Do you pay any attention to the comments you get on the comment section online?
If you notice, I don't think we have a comment section anymore.
Okay.
We have dropped that. We've let Facebook carry that.
Yeah.
And the answer is no.
Yeah. Yeah. Because at some point it's just counterproductive.
Right. It is. It doesn't. Yeah. 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 I always tell my wife, never look at the comments. Never look at the comments.
Yeah. Yeah. Because you're really not there to have a dialogue. You're there to give information out, I guess. Right,
right, right. Right. And
you can consume it or not as you see fit. Exactly.
And, you know, if somebody comments or sends me a note and one of the first words out of their mouth is, I'm a subscriber, yeah, I pay attention.
Sure. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You were at the AJC. First of all, has anybody been there besides you for 40 years?
Oh, we've had plenty of people. I mean, like Furman Bisher there.
No,
I think,
but I mean, who are there still?
Right? No. I'm the longest tenured person in the newsroom at this point.
I was going to say, you were there with people like Furman Bisher, with people like Louis Cazard.
Yep.
and
Celestine.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yeah, yeah.
And those days are sort of gone. There's nobody.
Yeah, there may be one or two people who remember Louis now.
Mm-hmm.
And Celestine, but yeah.
Yeah. Before we wrap this up, I do want to ask you, what do you see as the future of the American newspaper, or maybe newspapers in general? Are they coming back? Are they at least holding their own?
And the big answer is, I don't know. We have Cox was, you know, Cox once had this stable of TV stations and the stable of newspapers. I mean, we were in Dayton, we were in Palm Beach, Atlanta was the largest one. We had Austin. We had a number of newspapers. We sold off the TV stations. I think that we still have a minority stake in WSB, but it's a minority stake. And the Atlanta Journal-Constitution is the only newspaper now owned by Cox. How we are going to meet financing is something we're trying to find out over the next 5 years or so. You know, mm-hmm. you know, and some newspapers have tried to do it as a nonprofit. You know, others have, you know, are looking at the public broadcasting route. You know, have fundraisers and such. So I don't know. I know I will have the rare luxury of probably being able to leave on my own accord, which is, you know, all I ask at this point.
Mm-hmm.
When the time comes, I think my career will end before the newspaper does. One of the big things that's happened just this month is the Columbus Ledger Inquirer has stopped Saturday publication.
Wow.
You know, it's gone to online only on Saturday.
Mm-hmm.
That's a pretty big development in Georgia journalism.
It is. You were mentioning earlier something, the Toccoa Bureau of the Anderson paper. I mean, that is a relic from the past, right? I mean,
right.
Does such a thing even exist anymore?
Right. Essentially, this tiny newspaper based in a mill town in South Carolina put out in two newspapers,
mm-hmm.
you know, one on the Georgia side, one on the South Carolina side.
Yeah. And there's clearly a market for it at that point.
Right.
Yeah. I know that if other people were sitting right here, they would be asking you all sorts of questions that I sort of am leery to go into, this being a podcast about history, such as, what do you think about Donald Trump? What do you think about the current political climate? And I want to ask you some of that, but I want to phrase it a little bit differently.
Mm-hmm.
We keep hearing that this president is, in some ways, that his behavior is unprecedented. Not unpresidential, but it's unprecedented in the way that he behaves and the way that he acts. Some people say he's crazy like a fox. Some people say he's crazy. As a political observer of 40 years and then some, obviously it goes back, I mean, your political sensibilities go back beyond 40 years. Where do you place him in terms of his, not his performance, like rate him? I don't want you to grade mm-hmm. him per se, but in terms of giving us is there a precedent for a president like this, or really, or are we in your opinion uncharted territory?
I think pretty much unprecedented. I think, you know, in terms of in populism, I think your only parallel maybe with Andrew Jackson, and with, you know, and his, you know, attitude toward minorities as well. And then there's James Buchanan, who kind of ushered in the Civil War. He didn't. He stoked kind of divisions within the nation at that point. So those are the two. What I try to tell people is that Donald Trump is a symptom. He's not the cause. And I will. I'm down here to talk to the Rotary Club, and I will. I will certainly go into this topic. What we're kind of on we are just at the brink of a very interesting demographic change in the United States. You know, in by 2025, Georgia will probably be a majority minority state. By, you know, depending on whether you talk to the Census Bureau or Pew Research, you know, the nation will be a majority minority in 2044 or maybe 2055. I can't remember which one. You know, it's coming. And we're going to be faced with a very interesting question. I mean, and that's you know, I see the 2016 presidential campaign played out in that venue, in that angst over that shift, right? If you'll recall, the first time the South was asked to become a multiracial democracy, we blew it. That was Reconstruction and Jim Crow,
mm-hmm.
and that's what's facing us right now, is whether we're going to be, whether we're actually a tribal European nation, or whether we are truly a nation of ideals, and we're going to find that out. You know, I may be dead before we know the answer, but my kids won't be. That's what they're going to be settled with.
Is it fair to say we've been through this before? I mean, one would argue that in the 1960s, right, with all of desegregation, with everything that came from 1955 till about 1970, was we asked those same kind of questions,
right? But
didn't
but
we?
but the threat wasn't there. You know, the governance threat was there in the South, and that was why it was so violent. But if you were in Michigan, you know, African American population was probably maybe 8% of the total. You know, when I was in 1965, When I was 10 years old, 89% of Americans were white, you know, but we had changes in birth rates. We had a 1960s change in immigration policy, you know, a rise in Asians and Hispanics coming over because of that, not because of what's happening on the border right now. You know, that's the repercussions of that is happening right now. That's what's driving this demographic shift. Mm-hmm. And the change in demographic is reflected in generational attitudes. You've got this incredible difference in political attitudes. You know, there's this huge dividing mark between people under 40 and people under 50 and people over 50. And we're just now hitting it.
Mm-hmm. How do you see this playing out in Georgia?
Well, like I said, you're probably going to get majority minority 2025. Generally, demographics are a leading indicator. The political impact lags behind that, you know. But what it means is you're going to have many more campaigns for the next, you know, decade or two, like the 2018 gubernatorial campaign.
Highly contested.
And with a lot of dog whistling going on both sides. Mm-hmm. Brian Kemp and Donald Trump kind of employing the same strategy of really intensifying the white rural vote, which I would argue had its precursor in Sonny Perdue's 2002 campaign. And of course, the Democrats beginning to build on yet another biracial coalition in the metro areas and north of I-20.
And do you see this all going in a direction that will be? I know you're saying we're going to find out. Do you look to the future of Georgia and of this country with hope or with trepidation?
I'm always. If you're covering politics, you have to be an optimist. I mean, that's the only way to survive in there. So I look at it optimistically. I've seen us swing and miss when it comes to race and political power in the United States many, many times. And you know, part of me wants desperately at one point to know that we'll hit the ball. You know, a lot of this will depend on Republican behavior, you know, and whether they decide it's going to be a choice on that side of the political column of whether they actually move to broaden their tent. You know, when Mitt Romney lost in the presidential campaign in 2012, you know, you had that autopsy, and they said we need to widen the tent, we need to bring in minorities, and. Donald Trump did just the opposite of that. You know, he doubled down on white voter, rural voter intensity. You know, in 2015, the Georgia GOP had a minority outreach staffer, a guy whose only job was to reach out to African Americans. They don't have that job anymore. You know, if they can, they're going to have to. That's going to be the key to me to whether this works or not. Whether we can get past whether the Republican Party can adapt itself to a multiracial as a multiracial party.
Do you see? One could argue that the Democrats are having their own problems right now between pulling themselves back toward the center or pulling back to the left. Do you think that there is any? Is there? You know, once upon a time in the 1850s, the Whig Party. Mm-hmm. Splintered and became the Republican Party, among other things.
Yeah, I think 54.
Yep.
1854.
And yet we've never really had a realignment since then. Do you see in the future, is there any thought that either the Republicans are going to split into what one might call a Republican Party, which governs in the way, let's say, of a Jeb Bush or a John Kasich, and a very conservative party? Some people might call it other things, but I will call it a conservative party of people who are like Donald Trump, and on the other side, a Democratic Party that splits off into something that one might call progressive or others might call something else that's far left, and a Democratic Party.
I think as long as we've got an electoral college system, that kind of argues against it. I think it's
a winner take all.
As long as you've got a winner take all portion on the Electoral College, and I think we're stuck with a two party system. Mm-hmm. And what you'll see is if a good idea on a third party comes up, you know, somebody will grab it. You've seen that with marijuana, and the libertarians.
I mean, one could argue, and I made this argument in 2016, that if the American people had had a choice between, on the presidential ballot, of Bernie Sanders, Hillary Clinton, Donald Trump, and or I should say somebody like Jeb Bush and Donald mm-hmm. Trump, or even John Kasich, it might have been a very different outcome. Now, it might not because of the Electoral College
system. Yeah, I mean, the best we've done on that score is Ross Perot.
Yeah. Yeah.
And did he get? I think he got maybe 19% of the vote. I think mm-hmm. somewhere out in there.
Yeah.
But no, I don't. You don't
see that happening.
Not at this moment. Yeah. No, I don't think so.
One
I
party
think
imploding
look,
and becoming.
Yeah, I think.
Else.
I mean, if you, you know, yes, you see Democrats moving off to the left, but you also see kind of this desire, this realization that they know that they need the center. You know, Stacey Abrams in the 2018 gubernatorial campaign made a great deal of about bringing new voters in, and she did that. Mm-hmm. She did that, mm-hmm. but she came as close as she did because you saw a defection of many white voters, especially in North Metro Atlanta. Stacey Abrams did better in among white voters than Jason Carter did. 4 years before that,
in 2014,
mm-hmm. and I don't think, so I think there's a center there. You know, it may get moved this way or that way. I still think identity is going to be the key to whether we survive this or not.
Oh, do you say survive? You mean that literally?
Yeah, I
truly
do.
The Republic is actually in peril.
I think
this is as good a way to end this as anything.
Look, I think that we have to decide whether we are going to have whether we're going to return to normal order. I think if we don't come to grips with what America is and who we are in this decade or the next, then yeah, I think we're in peril. You know, we're doing this podcast in the headquarters of the Georgia Historical Society, and one of the first things that Todd Gross showed me was that letter from Thomas Jefferson that's hanging in the parlor, where Jefferson is an old man. It's the year before he dies, and things aren't working out for him for his party, and he's saying, well, maybe I'm not sure that this is the right that we chose the right path.
Maybe the people are not as smart as I thought they were.
Exactly.
Yeah.
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 So it's going to be, look, it's going to take some very active voters over the next two decades to make sure that we stay on track as a nation.
I was going to ask you, and I should say that Thomas Jefferson, of course, was in some ways, his lament is the same as anyone who is fading into their political twilight and they see changes on the horizon mm-hmm. that they just don't understand. If this is the new normal, one could argue, and we could talk about this for the next hour, and unfortunately we can't, but one could argue that if this is the new normal, if this hyper-partisanship, this absolute refusal of one party not to work with the other, it's a sort of a zero-sum game, if that is the new normal, will our Democratic and Republican, and I use both of those with a small, mm-hmm. small letters, will our institutions still be able to contain that moving forward, or do you think we are really headed for some sort of political suicide? Maybe that's a horrible question.
No. If we don't change, if we don't alter course, if we don't, and look,
and for you that means what?
We need a political system that is not based on race. We need a political system in which African Americans have a voice on the Republican side. African Americans have a voice on the Democratic side. That you are not feeling isolated if you're a white person or a Hispanic person, and in either party, you know you need to have the identity politics is a suicide pact, at bottom line, And if you and we're in that direction, and if we do not alter that direction, then yeah, I think we're headed for trouble.
Mm-hmm. How does history inform your writing, or the way you think about politics?
Oh, it's I never stop reading history. I mean, right now there's a my daughter, by the way, is, you know, she got her master's in history, and she teaches history over in North Cobb High School, my oldest. And so it's, you know, it's part of the family discussion. I'm reading. I've got about 3 books open right now. I've got The Silk Roads, which is kind of a wonderful book that says we ought to push the center of the world, or the early world, more toward Asia than Europe that we have now. Denmark Vesey's Garden, which is the history of race in Charleston. What else is out there? The other one is a detective novel. That doesn't count. I'm in the middle of Barbara Tuchman's Distant Mirror, which was the first. That was the first history book that I read, and I said, "Oh, this is what it's about. This is the marriage between good history and good writing, mm-hmm. and good analysis." Mm-hmm. The history of and as far as history's influence, you can't write about Georgia in 2019 unless you understand Georgia in 1830, 1850, 1860, 1870, 1890, 1930. You have to know about the 1906 riots in Atlanta, which were started by newspapers, by the way, mass media. You have to know about the civil rights movement. You have to know about not just King, but the people under King. It's a very informing way to do journalism.
Jim Galloway has been our guest. Jim is the current political columnist for the Atlanta Journal-Constitution, lead writer and founder of AJC's Political Insider blog, editor and writer for the AJC over 40 years. Jim Galloway, thanks for joining us today.
No, thank you. Enjoyed it.
My thanks to Jim Galloway of the Atlanta Journal-Constitution for joining us for this interview. You can find Jim's Political Insider blog on the AJC website at ajc.com. The hardest working engineer in show business, the czar of our Tallahassee office, as well as the captain of the GHS cheese rolling team, is our very own Brendan Cannonball Crellin. Our erstwhile producer is GHS Education Coordinator Extraordinaire Lisa War Eagle Landers. Our Off the Eaton Path fact checker is Ella Fino, theme music by Pink Zebra. Our groundskeeper is Mo DeLon, and our French dog walking intern is Poupon de Grasse. Beverages provided this week by Drost Brewery in Ellijay, where their motto is beer, because everybody needs a hobby. Catering provided by Hagee's House of Tacos in Cumming, Georgia, where political science majors always get 10% off. If you have an iPhone, you can find our podcast at the App Store or on the podcast app on your phone. If you have an Android, look for us at Google Play, and you can now listen on Spotify as well. Tell your friends and family, because this podcast, like all the others, is worthy of a vote recount. You can find out everything about the Georgia Historical Society at georgiahistory.com and the Georgia History Festival at georgiahistoryfestival.org. Be sure and like Off the Eaten Path on Facebook as well. Please also check out my blog and similarly gerrymandered podcast at eatenpath.georgiahistory.com. If you have any comments about how much you enjoyed this show or about life in general, drop me a line at sdeaton@georgiahistory.com. Please direct all complaints about content or the sound of my voice or the damage this podcast may be doing to your phone to the head of our complaints division here at Off the Eaton Path, Begonia Payne Diaz, assisted by customer service specialist Dawn Bottomy. I'm Stan Deaton with the Georgia Historical Society. As always, thank you for listening, and remember, it's all revisionist history. We hope you'll come back next time. So long, everybody.